be seated. I'm glad to see everybody this morning. I didn't know how many would show up, and I'm thrilled that you're here. We are going to continue our study this morning from Paul's letter to the Ephesians. Call this series God's Mystery Revealed because of how many times Paul in this letter talks about the mystery of God. And as a reminder, mystery of God is not a puzzle that we have to figure out. It just simply means that previously the gospel was at least partially hidden, and is, at the time of Paul's writing, has now been revealed. And so Paul refers to it as the mystery. We are in the last chapter, in the last part of Ephesians, which is the practical section. Many of Paul's letters had a practical section that followed the deeper theological section, and we are in the practical section. And the context for this morning's lesson, we're going to start in chapter 6, verse 5. You heard the reading from Charlie this morning. But the context goes all the way back to the middle of chapter 5, where Paul had been talking about ways that we should walk, Christians should walk, using walk as a metaphor. And one of the ways he had said we should walk is we should walk in wisdom. He said, if you walk in wisdom, you're going to be filled with the Spirit. And if you're filled with the Spirit, there's some things you're going to do. And one of those things that you're going to do is you're going to, and I've got this at the top of the handout, by the way, if you've we've got some visitors this morning. If you've got a copy of the bulletin, just flip it over. That's the handout for this morning's lesson. I realized this morning there was one piece that I left off the handout. I'll talk more about that in just a minute. But I've got the note there at the very top that says, back to chapter 5, verse 21, one of the things you're going to be doing if you're filled with the Spirit, if you're walking according to wisdom, is you're going to be submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ. And from that phrase that Paul gives, he then goes through three relationships. Now, the last couple of weeks, we've talked about the first two of those relationships. The first one, husbands and wives. The second, fathers and children. And in both of those cases, Paul is talking to two sides of a relationship where one side in Greco-Roman society, well, Tim, what's Greco-Roman society? Well, the culture created by the Greeks and the Romans. You had the Greek Empire followed by the Roman Empire. And in that culture, that society, you had one side of these two relationships that had no rights. Okay, the first one, husbands and wives, in Greco-Roman society, wives had no rights. And Paul presents marriage in a very radical way for that time, in that he says, hey, both sides, husbands and wives, have a responsibility in submitting to one another. And again, it's a radical idea in that culture that the husband had a responsibility to the wife. And so he presents that, and then in a similar way with fathers and children, or we could say more generically, parents and children. I think he singled out fathers because, in Greco-Roman society, fathers had absolute authority within the family. Children had no rights. But he begins with children and then ultimately talks to fathers and actually presents that fathers, you have a responsibility as well. You have a role in God's plan. And again, presenting them as this idea of mutual submission. Children and fathers or parents have a responsibility to each other, which was a radical way of thinking. This morning, we're going to look at the third relationship. And you may think, look at this one and go, well, this one doesn't apply to me because this is about slaves and masters. And fortunately, in our country at this time, I don't expect that any of us have ever lived in a slave-master relationship. So in that sense, yes, this doesn't necessarily directly apply in that sense, but there are two things here. There are principles in this lesson that apply universal to all relationships. Okay? But secondly, many of us, if not most of us, either have been in our past, are currently, or will be in our future, have been employed by somebody, right? We work for somebody, or have worked, or will work for somebody, or maybe a few of us have even been in a position where we were the employer, where we employed people. And so while that's not the same as a master-slave where you actually purchase the rights to someone, there are things from this lesson that we can pull if we are employees of how we work for the people who employ us, or if we are employers, how we treat the people who are employed by us. Does that make sense? And so, again, while fortunately, we don't, you know, in this country, we don't live in a time where, you know, where there are masters and slaves, though that is still present in our world. There are things here that can apply to us, okay? All right, so I want to get that out of the way before we start. Now, let's talk about what Paul has to say about masters and slaves. Just like the other two before, Paul starts with the side of the relationship that has no rights. He starts with bondservants. Before we even get to that, I want to ask the question, why is Paul talking about slavery to begin with? And if you look on the left-hand side, I just put a note there that says Paul is dealing with the reality of the world at that time. Paul is writing to Christians who live in a world where there is slavery. There is the ownership of humans. And so he is dealing with the reality of that time. Now, unfortunately, passages like this and other passages that talk about the master-slave relationship, and I've got a few listed above that, all of those written by Paul, 1 Corinthians, Colossians, Titus, Philemon. In the past, people have used these passages to say that, well, look, the Bible endorses slavery. And because of that, there are, if you look hard enough today, you can find that when Christians stand for any moral issue, take a position on any moral issue, someone will go, well, look, Christians used the Bible to support slavery, you know, 150 years ago. So why should we pay attention to what Christians have to say now? So we have to be very careful. Because I do not believe that Paul, in this passage or any of the passages where he wrote about slavery and the master-slave relationship, is endorsing slavery. He is just dealing with the reality of the times. Okay? He's dealing with the reality of the times. And what were the reality of the times? Okay, you look on the right-hand side, I said, why address slaves? The first note I have under there is that at this time, we're talking first century, Paul is writing to probably, you know, a number of churches in Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey. Ephesus would have been included. We talked about that way back in the introduction. But the reality of the time in the Roman Empire was it was estimated that there were 60 million slaves. 60 million. Okay? Or, put it another way, I've got this in there, one-third of the total population of the Roman Empire. And so I want you to think about, if this were written to churches in Asia Minor, again, most likely this was a circular letter, the oldest manuscripts that we have don't even have the word Ephesus in the beginning. But probably written to a number of churches in Asia Minor, there are people who are reading this letter who have been converted who are what? They're slaves. Right? That's the reality. And if they are slaves and they have been converted to be followers of Jesus Christ, they must. It's hard for me to put myself in their shoes, but I have to believe that they had questions. What does this mean? I'm still owned by this other person, but I've given my life to Christ. What do I do? What do I do? I mean, again, hard for me to put myself in their position, but if I'm forced to, I have to believe they have those questions. And so again, Paul is dealing with the reality of the world that he's writing to. We're going to talk about masters in just a minute. But there has to have been many who were converted who were slaves. And so Paul's addressing that. And again, just like the way Paul presented mutual submission in marriage, and mutual submission between fathers, parents, and children, where both of those were radical ideas in Greco-Roman society. What Paul has to present here about masters and slaves and mutual submission, this is a radical way of thinking. And maybe even was the beginning of the seeds of what led to the emancipation of many slaves in the Roman Empire. Maybe. Because this was a very different way of thinking. Because Paul is presenting this, that if you are a slave who has been converted to Christ, you now have a Christian duty. That's a very different way of thinking. The way slaves were viewed in the Roman Empire, and I've got a quote, not directly a quote, but the thoughts of Aristotle. You've probably heard of Aristotle. But he was quoted as saying that slaves were no more than living tools. That was the thinking of the day. But Paul presents this as a Christian service, a service done unto Christ. We'll talk more about that in just a minute. So this is radical thinking. Because ultimately where Paul's going to go with this is that masters and slaves both have a responsibility to each other. And he's even going to say it's the same responsibility. Okay, so it's radical thinking. With that in mind, let's talk about a few things. If you look at the bottom of the handout, I've got a note on the left that says the role of slaves. Okay? The role of slaves. The first thing that Paul says is in verse 5, bondservants, what? Obey. That's the role. Obey. So if you're questioning, now that I am a convert and a follower of Christ, what should I do? And Paul says, obey. Obey your earthly masters. That's your role. Obey. Everything else he has to say about their role is how they should obey. But the overriding concept here is, he says, basically follow the instructions of your masters. That's the rule. I mean, that's the instruction. That's your role, is to obey. Okay? Obey, and he very specifically points out your earthly masters. Why does he specify earthly? He's going to get to that. Because he's going to make a point that you have more than just an earthly master. You now have a master who is in heaven if you've given your life to Christ. But he says, obey. Follow their instructions. Now, again, everything else he says is how they're supposed to do that. How are you supposed to obey? This is where I left something out. Jeff and I were talking on the phone Friday, and as we were talking, I said, well, he was asking about songs, and I said, well, as we're talking, I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to fit all this stuff on this handout. And what happened with me trying to fit all this stuff on the handout was I removed something and forgot to put it back. And then the way I do it is I make my handout first to figure out what I'm going to do with blanks, then I make my slides, and then I send the slides to Mike. And I didn't figure out this morning that I forgot to put something back. So it's not in the handout. It's not in the slide. So we'll just have to, you have to write some stuff in, okay, if you want to fill in the blanks. But the first thing he says about, you know, how they should obey, this is the part that's left out, okay, is he says, with fear and trembling. That word translated fear in other places in Scripture is translated respect, okay? So if I were going to do a blank here, I would put respect. So he says, you know, respect the authority of your master, your earthly master. That's how you should do it, okay? Respect with fear and trembling. We tend to think of fear and trembling as a relationship to God, but here he says, treat your earthly master. Again, if we're thinking about employee-employer, if you're an employee, treat your employer with respect, with recognizing their authority. You know, in many cases, the employer is one of the ones that owns the business. So recognize them for their position, okay, out of respect. The second thing, and this is where we pick back up with the outline, is he says, fear and trembling with a sincere heart. Okay, sincere heart. So the word I have there is just simply sincerity. With sincerity, okay. I mentioned in the upper left-hand corner that there's some other passages where Paul teaches about this similar thing. And then you can consider Philemon is really less about instruction and more about it's a plea from Paul to a master to accept a departed slave back. But In Colossians, which I've mentioned this a number of times in this study, that Colossians is like a sister letter to Ephesians. Many of the things that are in Ephesians are also in Colossians. Okay, and so there's a section of Colossians, a shorter section, that deals with these same three relationships. Okay, and one of the things he says, when he talks about masters and slaves, to slaves, he says, work heartily. Work hard. But the idea with sincerity is you do it for the right reasons. You're not just doing it so they can just see you. And when they see you, they're like, oh, he's working hard. And as soon as they leave, then you go back to, you know, being lazy. Okay? How do I know that? Because in verse 6, he says, not by way of eye service, as people pleasers. Just work hard all the time. And let your motivation be that your intention is to do a good job all the time, no matter who's watching you. Okay? No matter who's watching you. I've been thinking about this illustration all week, and I hesitated, because I was like, this illustration is about a teacher. And I hesitated because I hold up teachers in the highest esteem. To me, teachers are the most important, least paid people on the planet. Okay? So teachers, I know we got some teachers in the room. Hear me when I say that. Most important, least paid people on the planet. Okay? But I can't help it when I read this about eye service, I think about a teacher I had when I was in elementary school. And she was a good teacher, but she was not organized. I mean, really not organized. Kind of flighty, we might say. And I remember I came into class one day and it was like, who is this woman? It's like all of a sudden it's like everything is perfect, everything is organized. And then I look and the principal's standing in the back of the room for observation. And it's like, oh, I know what's going on. And then after about an hour, the principal walked out the door. And this is why this stuck in my head, because I remember as soon as the door had latched, she sat down on her desk, the desk was in the front of her, and went, woo! Yeah! Thank goodness that's over. And it just was, so it stuck in my head, right? You know, but I've seen this in my years as a consultant. I'd go into a client's office and be like, man, this place is cleaner than it's ever been. And everybody is like, everybody's dressed up and everybody's like, you know, respectful. And it's like, normally this place is chaos. And be like, what's going on? We got people from the corporate office here today, you know. So we understand this concept. But Paul says, if you're a slave, and for us, if you're an employee, work with sincerity all the time. Do it from the heart. Okay, give your best at all times. You know, I think about Joseph. Those of you that have been reading through the Bible with me, we've already read through the whole life of Joseph. You think about Joseph. Joseph never had anything handed to him. I mean, every step of the way, it's like tragedy, 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 tragedy. But every step of the way, what? He earned the favor of his master. He was a slave. Of his jailer, he earned the favor. Because he worked hard. And so to the point where even when he was a slave, and then when he was a prisoner, he was in charge of everybody else. Because he worked hard all the time. He did it with sincerity. Okay? So he's an example. And so he says, you don't do this with eye service. Don't just do this to be people pleaser. Work hard. That's how we obey. We work hard at all times. The next thing, which comes in verse 8. Actually, no. Verse 7. Rendering service with a good will. Okay, so the next phrase is goodwill. All these blanks come straight from the text, by the way. Goodwill. Do it with goodwill. And I've got a note there that this is the opposite of being under compulsion. And the reference that I have there is 2 Corinthians 9, which has nothing to do with masters and slaves. That passage is about giving, right? And instruction for giving is to do it not under compulsion. You know, give as you purposed in your heart, not under compulsion. I think the same concept here is what Paul uses in giving. Work cheerfully with goodwill. Don't do it like, oh, I've got to do this. You know, do it with cheerfulness. Don't act like you're being forced and prodded to do what you're expected to do. Okay, cheerfully, all right? That's the way you should work. You know, how we should obey, how we should work. Now, there's another aspect of this how that comes in the center column at the bottom. Okay? And you see this sprinkled in throughout the instruction to slaves, to bondservants. Okay? He says how you should do this, how you should obey. The first one comes in verse 5. As you would Christ. In verse 6, as bondservants of Christ. Also in verse 6, doing the will of God. And then in verse 7, do it as to the Lord. And so what Paul, he's got this sprinkled throughout, is he is reminding them that now you don't just have an earthly master. You have a heavenly master. And so he says, everything that you do in obeying, you should do it as though you are working directly for the Lord. You know, I've got a note there in verse 7. He says, you know, work as to the Lord, not to man. So when you're thinking about your work, don't think about, I just got to please this one person. No, no, no. You got to think about, I'm working for the Lord. That's a concept that we can apply no matter what, right? Whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord, right? You can apply that to everything. Whatever you do as a child of God should be for God. It should be for Him. And so Paul says, I'm calling you to something higher. I'm calling you to something higher. And that is to work as though you are working for God. Okay, and then he says this, and this is in verse 8, knowing that whatever good anyone does, this he will receive back from the Lord, whether he is bondservant or free. And I think Paul's talking about eternal reward, not, hey, if you do good, you're going to be wealthy, you're going to be free. No, he's talking about the future. And I have a reference there to Romans 8. Also, there's Colossians 3. Colossians 3:24, he says, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance as your reward. As an earthly slave, or, you know, that there was no guarantee of any material reward. But what Paul's saying is, if you're a child of God and you do good, I mean, you live how you should, there is your future in glory is secure. Because Christ has already paid for that. So it's secure. And I have a reference there in Romans 8 where Paul says, I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed to us. Again, those are principles that apply to everything. Whatever we're going through in this life, he says, the future that is secure is so much better than what you're going through right now. I mean, James talked about that in Christine's funeral yesterday, about hope. You know, living a life, if you live a life without hope, wow, what a sad life. But we live with the most hope of anyone because we believe that our future is secure. Not here on this earth. Things are going to come and go on this earth. You're going to have good times and bad times, but we're hanging on for a future where it's all glory with God. And Paul says, hey, you live how you should, not to earn something, but as your motivation is, you're serving God. You continue serving God, your future is secure. You have a future that is secure. Those are the principles he gives for slaves. And again, I believe we can think about that in terms of whether it's employees or just in anything that we do, these principles apply. But here's the really revolutionary part of what Paul has to say here, is that he actually gives responsibilities to the masters. Now, you may go, well, okay, I ran out of room, so I don't have any more writing on here about why masters. Because I got why slaves, I don't have why masters. But why masters? Well, again, I think there is the reality that if there are that many slaves, that there's also enough masters that there's probably some masters who legally have ownership of someone else who were converted. Right? Who were converted. And you may say, well, how come Paul didn't just immediately say, just release all your slaves? And the only thing I can point to is that whether you talk about the writings of Paul or anyone else in the New Testament, they didn't try to overthrow any human institution. But in every situation, they tried to preach and teach the principles of God. And I think what you can see if you really dig into this is even though Paul doesn't say, just free all your slaves, the instructions that he gives, if they really apply them, would completely transform their view of what of that relationship, right? Well, how do I know that? We think about everything that he just said to slaves, okay? Obey, have respect, do it with sincerity, do it with goodwill, with cheerfulness. Do it as though you're doing it for the Lord. Everything for the Lord. Now, what's the first instruction to masters? Do the same. Do the same. What do you mean? I own them. They're my property. Paul says, do the same. That's the word. Same. Do the same. Paul has now just elevated it to where they're equal in this relationship. That's radical for this time. They're equal in this relationship. Do the same. You mean treat them with respect, treat them with sincerity, treat them with goodwill? Yes, do the same. Do the same. And again, if they truly follow that instruction, that's going to completely change the relationship, right? Completely change it. He doesn't just say do the same. But before we jump off that, this is like the golden rule, right? I got one a couple times in Scripture, but I've got one of those from the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 7. Do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. Paul is saying, use the golden rule. I mean, not exactly in those words, but basically, use the golden rule. Do the same. Do to them as you would have them do to you if your positions were reversed. Again, radical thinking. And I've got a note there that this places masters and slaves at the same level. Well, Tim, if that were the case, wouldn't there no longer be masters and slaves? It's kind of the idea, right? It's kind of the idea. Change your way that you view this relationship. Think back to chapter 5, verse 21, that began this whole thing. Submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ. In every one of these relationships, there is equal responsibility on both sides. Husbands and wives, fathers and children, masters and slaves. Do the same. The second thing he says is, stop threatening. In other words, I know that in this society, under Roman law, as a master, you can do whatever you want to do. You can treat them however you want to treat them. But Paul here is calling to a higher level of accountability than Roman law, than societal traditions and norms. He's calling them to a higher level of accountability, a higher standard. Stop threatening. Treat them well. Don't be demanding. The next thing he says, remember, knowing that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven. So the next one, you have the same master, but I'm the master. No. You both serve the true one master. You both serve God, serve his son, Jesus Christ. You know, again, four times he had said to the slaves, do this as you do it to the Lord. Do this as bondservants of Christ. He had already said to the masters, do the same. Now he's just reiterating it. Remember, you both serve the same master. Again, you're now at the same level, right? And now Paul's really going to drive that idea home with this next statement, okay? This next statement. So knowing that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and that there is no partiality with him. And I got a quote in the text there from Colossians 4, verse 1, if I can pull that up. He says, masters, treat your bondservants justly and fairly, knowing that you also have a master in heaven. And then Galatians, another letter written by Paul about partiality. There is neither Jew nor Greek. There is neither slave nor free. There is no male and female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. And so Paul is saying, view your servant, your slave, as God does. And that is, there's no distinction between the two of you. Both equally lost without Christ. Both in need of Christ. And both have the same master. So what Paul is doing here is he's elevating them to mutual responsibility, to the same level. It's quite radical thinking. But the overriding concept in all of this is they both now serve a higher power. They both are servants of a higher power. We're going to close, and when we close, we're going to have an invitation song that Jeff picked out. And the name of this song is Pierce My Ear. Most of us probably know the song, but you may not know the meaning behind it. The thought, this is taking a concept from Exodus 21. It's taking a concept from Exodus 21 where there is given instructions regarding slaves and masters. And in that, it talks about that a slave can be compelled to serve for 6 years, but after 6 years, they're given the opportunity to be free. But if the slave chooses to stay with the master rather than be free, they will have their ear pierced with an awl. And so this song, this hymn, is referencing that and saying, Lord, pierce my ear. What's the metaphor there? I want to be your eternal servant. I am giving my allegiance to you. The concept here, if you said, hey, what's the one overriding concept through this relationship? It's that both of you serve God forever. You both have the same master. And so when you're singing the words of this song, think about that idea that you're saying, God, pierce my ear. What you're actually saying is, Lord, let me be your servant forever. Okay, please be my master forever, which is, again, the overriding concept here. The reason why that's important, why that matters, is because when we talk about God's mystery, well, the mystery is the gospel. And the gospel we're not compelled to follow the gospel. We're not forced to follow the gospel. We have a choice. And as I say a lot, that choice comes down to really fundamentally, am I going to continue as my own master, or pretending like I'm my own master? Or am I willing to give my life to someone else to be my master? That's really what the choice is. The consequences of the choice are this. If I continue to be my own master, what am I going to do with my life? Whatever I want to do. Do what I want. But if I give my life over to Christ, what am I going to do? I'm going to do my best to do what He wants. Why? Not to earn it. Can't work for it, but I do what He wants because He's my master. And if I believe He's the only way to have that forever reward, then I'm going to do what He wants. And so the call of Christ is always there, not just during invitation time, but it's the call to a higher master. Just like Paul reminded the slaves and the masters. It's a call to have a higher master, a different master. A master who's not affected by the things of this earth. But if we give our lives to that master, then our future is secure. Our future is secure because He has already secured it. If you're here this morning and you've never given your life to Christ, we encourage you to think about that commitment this morning. If there's anything else we can do for you, please come while we sing our invitation song.